So if you look up the word myth in a dictionary, you get all sorts of discussion about Greek gods and things like that. But down at the bottom there is perhaps more relevant to what I'm getting at, an unproved or false collective belief that's used to justify a social institution, and I cross that out and I put in cell technology. What really happens is usually the experts are aware of these myths, and they will make properly qualified statements, and then somebody simplifies the statement and takes away the qualifications and makes a statement that's no longer correct, and then you have a myth that's born. So let's start with number five, and we'll work our way up the list to number one. Number five, cathode exotherms above 200 degrees determine cell safety. Cathode exotherms are definitely important. And what I'm talking about is, as Khalil showed us in the previous talk, you delithiate any of these cathodes and you heat them up, and presumably you keep the electrolyte there and you look for heat evolved. And these tests have big names like differential scanning calorimetry or accelerated rate calorimetry. And when you're interpreting these things, you have to keep track of two different concepts, probability and severity. And what I'm talking about is the probability of getting the cell or part of the cell hot enough to get into a thermal runaway condition. And then if that happens, what is the severity? So how bad is the thermal runaway after it's gotten into a thermal runaway condition? And these are quite different concepts, and a lot of the features you see in the data, some of them will talk about the probability aspect, and some of them will talk about the severity. So I just picked an example here, some DSC peaks for NMC materials, and this graph is all about severity. It's not telling us much about probability. And the reason is because it's focusing on the large exotherms above 200 degrees, and perhaps there's something going on down here at lower temperature, where we usually focus on the anode, but you can't see that. So you really need a blow up of this area. So they're correctly identifying large peak areas here, which talk about the severity of an incident. And they also correctly talk about onset temperatures. But really, all you need is a tiny exotherm down in this region in order to get you up to the onset temperature. So here's another graph where you can see a little more action down at the low temperature. And I just circled this. There's something going on at 120 degrees. Now, whether that's an artifact of the test or whether there's a real exotherm there, I'm not sure, but there's no mention of that in the paper. So if you see anything down at that temperature, you have to zero in on it, you have to verify or debunk it, and you have to comment on it, because that little exotherm there could then get the cell up to a temperature where the anode takes over and heats the cell up to here where the cathode takes over again. And you can actually see these ping pong effects if you do accelerated rate calorimetry with different cell components. Different parts of the cell will heat the cell up to the next level where another part of the cell or another reaction takes over and heats it up further. And all of these reactions go towards the probability aspect until you get up to the high temperature range above 200 degrees. Okay, let's move on to myth number four. Flammable solvents are the cause of lithium ion safety problems. Well, I will admit they're certainly part of the story, but it's not all of the story. Or another way of stating it is, if only we had solvents that weren't flammable, everything would be okay. Non-flammable solvents do help, but we have to worry about some other things as well. And what I'm getting at is there's a lot of other combustible materials in the cell, and also flammability itself isn't the only issue. You can make cells with a lithium iron phosphate, which, as Khalil Amin told us, does not liberate oxygen. And even in those cells, you can have some safety problems. And so there's reactions going on there that don't involve liberated oxygen. So flammability is not always relevant. So let's just look at some of these other materials. And in order to put some real numbers, attach some real numbers to the discussion, we'll talk about a 18650 cell that's perhaps 2.5 amp hours. Oh. Thank you very much. So I've put down some quantities here. Typically, this cell will have 16 grams of NMC, 8 grams of graphite, 5 grams of electrolyte, some separator, some aluminum, and the mobile lithium is around 0.7 grams. And then we can work out how much oxygen is available. So if you take a delithiated NMC material and let it decompose, maybe you'll get 3/8 of an oxygen out. That's about 0.06 moles of O2. And we're going to look at how much heat we can get out of that oxygen. And of course, the phosphate material is stellar in this regard. It's not going to give us any oxygen, basically because those phosphorus atoms really lock the oxygen into the material. So here's a bunch of components in the cell with some masses and how much absolute kilojoules of energy are released if they fully combust, and how much oxygen is consumed. And you can see right away, there's not enough oxygen released to burn up everything. And here's the electrolyte solvents, and they give off a fair amount of heat. And even the DEC, assuming we have 50% DEC, that alone will consume more oxygen than is released by the cathode. But one thing I'd like to point out is the aluminum. It has a huge heat of reaction, and it will use a little more than the amount of oxygen we have, but not all of it, or, well, a little more than what we have. The point here is this is what's called a thermite reaction. So you have an oxidizing material mixed with a metal, and if you can get to high enough temperature, the thermite reaction goes very quickly and releases a huge amount of heat. And the aluminum burning of the aluminum, once you get into the severity area, you're up above 200 degrees, is very relevant to the severity of a thermal event. And it can be relevant to the probability aspect as well if you have local heating where an internal short occurs. And I'll talk about that in a second. Okay, number three. A lithium dendrite can hard short a cell and send it into thermal runaway. So before 1991, commercial lithium cells had the lithium metal anode. And since then, most commercial cells have replaced the anode with an intercalation compound, usually graphite. So by design, in a lithium metal cell, you're constantly stripping and plating the lithium. The lithium ion cells can plate lithium, but usually not if they're designed properly. Even a properly designed cell could plate lithium if you charge quickly at low temperature. But then you're talking about plating fairly small amounts of lithium compared to what you're plating every cycle with a lithium metal cell. And to show you what happens when you try and plate lithium, I stole a picture from an article by our illustrious host here. And basically, it looks like moss. It's called dendrites, but if you look at it under a microscope, it sort of looks like moss. And it's a very high surface area material. It will react quickly once you get a thermal event going. And here's a nice picture from Stephen Harris. This is a bead of graphite, or a circular graphite electrode. And not shown in the picture is the lithium electrode over here. And these are actually dendrites that have grown from the right-hand side here over towards the graphite material, and you can see how mossy it looks. Now, when you do this with a high-voltage cathode material, the lithium will work its way back through the separator, and eventually it will touch the cathode. And when it touches the cathode, you get these little voltage dips in your voltage curve. And so what's happening is the lithium touches the cathode, the cell voltage drops for a split second, and then something happens, that connection gets broken, and the voltage jumps back up again. And you see this happening over and over again. So what's going on here? As soon as the lithium metal touches the cathode, it's going to intercalate. There's 4 volts there pulling the lithium in. It's like a lithium vacuum. So that lithium dendrite cannot contact the cathode for very long at all. And that's what's happening in the voltage curve. You see the little spikes going down. I'm just emphasizing how high this voltage is. KT is only 0.025 electron volts. So we have something like 40 times KT here, which is a very strong force pulling the lithium in. So what actually happens with a lithium metal anode cell is typically you need to go hundreds or thousands of cycles beyond the first signs of failure where you see the little dips in the voltage curve. And by that time, you probably have on the order of 1 million or more shorts in the cell. So these are little dendrites. They're very close to the cathode. They're not touching continuously, but they will touch intermittently. The lithium will intercalate, and then they back off. And this was all studied at Moli Energy back in the late 1980s, before my time. And what can happen is local groups of shorts will heat up and get enough heat in a local area of the cell to initiate a thermal runaway. And commercial lithium-ion cells simply don't plate enough lithium to do this. You can actually cycle lithium-ion cells either at low temperature or just design them wrong with not enough graphite, and they will plate lithium every cycle, but you don't get these effects in the voltage curve, mainly because there's just not enough metallic lithium around to give you these millions of shorts through the separator. Okay, number two. The purpose of the nail test is to make sure the cell can survive a nail gun. There's a number of bodies, regulatory bodies, that specify a nail penetration test. And the purpose is actually to simulate an internal short. So it's not really what these guys are doing in the lab, shooting cells with nail guns. This became a little bit relevant when cells were introduced into the power tool market. Some of the power tool makers said, well, what would happen if somebody accidentally shoots the cell with a nail gun? So it became relevant for that, but for the most part, the purpose is to simulate an internal short. So let's have a look at what that's all about. The worst sort of safety event you can have is a spontaneous internal short. So that's caused usually by mechanical flaws in the cells. That could be included particles, sharp edges, burrs, folded corners, tab folding and bending, core collapse. And here's a X-ray photograph of a cathode tab pushing some electrodes out of the way. And you have to worry about whether that tab might eventually cut through the separator and touch an anode electrode. The nasty thing about this sort of safety problem is that there's no fix at the system level, and I think that was mentioned in one of the previous talks. As a pack designer or a vehicle designer, there's nothing you can do to prevent this sort of incident. It's all up to the cell designer and the cell manufacturer. So you really have to talk about cell design and cell manufacturing process controls when you're discussing this issue. And the vehicle makers are very aware of this, and they actually tell the cell makers how to make their cells to some extent in order to prevent these problems. So what happens when there's a spontaneous internal short? So I've drawn a spiral cell in this example, and then imagine, I drew a little red circle there, imagine there's a spontaneous short where that red circle is. What's going to happen? Well, I purposely drew the circle somewhere in the middle of the cell, so that means if we unrolled this whole stack of electrodes, we would have current flowing along the cathode through the short and back along the anode. So these are sort of normal currents flowing through the foils, but we've got a huge current flowing through the short. And as soon as you see that, you worry about very high current densities, and then you start thinking about Joule heating or I squared R heating at this local site. And the worst case is when the impedance of the short site is equal to the impedance of the cell. This is similar to impedance matching speakers in a stereo system. You get maximum volume and sound quality when the speakers match the impedance that the amplifier expects. And the same thing's going here. You get maximum power or maximum I squared R in the short site when you have impedance matching. Now, when a spontaneous internal short happens, you can imagine the impedance at the short site being almost anything. It might be much lower than the cell impedance, it might be much higher, or it might be close to matching. So now we're talking about a bit of a lottery here. How bad is this short going to be? And this is some very nice simulation work done by Kim Candler and, or Kim Smith and Pezarin. And basically they're simulating a stacked cell, and they're going to induce a short in one corner. And the top graphs here are the temperature, and the bottom is heat generation. So there's some heat being generated near the short site, and that heat was enough to ignite some sort of thermal runaway reactions that they're modeling. And you can see a reaction front moving through the cell with time, and the cell's heating up accordingly. So that's the sort of problem we're worried about. So here we're in the probability scenario. What's the probability of having an internal short? And if you do, what's the probability of that short site getting hot enough, which is connected to the impedance of the short site? And once the ignition starts, now we're into the severity region. So we're worried about the severity of these reactions as they move through the cell. So now, finally, let's talk about the nail test. And remember, the purpose of the nail test is to simulate an internal short. The trouble with the nail test is it punctures the cell, and it's shorting the cell many, many times in many places. Now, what can happen is the instant the nail goes in, it will immediately make a short in the first couple of layers here. And sometimes the cell will go into thermal runaway right away. And in other cells, the nail can go all the way through and sit there fuming away for a little while before you have a thermal runaway. And Khalil Amin showed us a film of that in the last talk. Now, the impedance of the short sites that the nail makes will vary wildly, probably from layer to layer and from test to test. And every detail of this test matters. The nail size, the tip shape, the nail speed, the temperature, the nail surface, whether the nail's electrically or thermally isolated. And so, given all that, and if you look at this picture carefully, you can see that it's quite different than an internal short, but it's probably the best simulation we have. Okay. And the last myth is that passing a nail test means your chemistry is robust under internal short conditions. So what happens is, first of all, you have to do a number of these tests to get a statistically meaningful result. If you make one cell, stick a nail in it and pass, and then run to the car company and say, I'm ready, they're not going to listen to you. The other thing is that the cell must short inside. There are some cells with very hard steel cans, and the nail just bends away from the cell. It doesn't even puncture the cell. So if that happens, you've defeated the purpose of the test. You can claim you've passed, but you haven't really done much useful. And the last thing I'll mention is cell designers can trick the test. So I guess I could do another talk, the top five nasty cell design tricks, but I'll save you four of them and just list one. What some cell makers have done is change the design of the cell in order to pass the test. The standard cell will have the can at anode potential, an anode electrode, and then a cathode electrode. And I'm not really trying to show the separator here, but these white areas in between, you can imagine there's a separator there. So the nail's going to hit the can. It's at anode voltage. Then it's going to hit the anode. It's still at anode voltage. Nothing happens. Then it's going to hit the cathode active material. And as soon as it touches the cathode active material, ignition can start. What some cell designers have done is put an extra wrap. This is a blow up of a spiral, so these layers are going around and around. This cathode layer can go around, the coating can stop, and now you've got bare aluminum foil around the outside of the jelly roll. What happens now is the nail goes in, it hits the can, which is at anode potential, and now it hits the aluminum foil. So now we've made a metal to metal short instead of a metal to active material short. No ignition will occur at this point, and you can diffuse a lot of current. There's double layer capacitance and a lot of current waiting to run through this nail. And it can do that without igniting anything. And then finally, if the nail keeps going, it will touch cathode active material. But by that time, we've dissipated a lot of the instantaneous current flow. And you can pass the test this way. Okay, so this basically defeats the whole purpose of the nail test. So we have to watch out for these sort of things when we're evaluating cells. And the only way to know about this really is to cut the cell open and look at it carefully. And that's it. Thank you.